Good morning, everybody. Today is Monday, December 18th, 2017. And this says Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Monday, everyone. It is a balmy 37 degrees and overcast here in upstate New York. So where do we leave off on Friday? We titled the show Neuroscience, Dopamine, Voice of God, EMF, TV, and Brain Manipulation. And we are going to take a look at a few things today. I found a couple interviews. Actually, my friend found a couple interviews over the weekend. I was kind of poking around in their library and found a few interviews today that I wanted to share with you. And speaking about EMF and the voice of God weapon that we had talked about on Friday, and that was that weapon that they had used during Iraq. It came out utilizing the sonic frequencies within the microwave spectrum. Remember, microwave is a part of the electromagnetic spectrum that is out there. It is where a lot of our cell phones operate and Wi-Fi. So we are bathed in microwave radiation on a daily basis. We also looked at some strange patents that had been found in regards to manipulating brain waves. This one was called nervous system manipulation by electromagnetic fields from monitors. And this was from June of 2001 that it was filed with the patent office, where they had found a way to apparently manipulate brain waves utilizing pulse frequencies to manipulate behavior and change emotion through the electromagnetic fields that surround us from our equipment. We've also talked about cell phone radiation and a lot of the studies that have been buried in regards to safety of being ubiquitously encased. I don't know if you call it encased, swimming in EMF. You can't get away from it anymore. So what we're going to take a look at today is two different interviews. They both came from electromagnetichealth.org. That's where we found the links that then took us to their Vimeo site. The first one is a doctor. He is a renowned New York City physician named Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez, and he talks about the health risks from EMF fields. And what I saw, it was kind of sad when I was reading the description here before the show. It says, weeks before his unexpected death in 2015, and once you hear this, you're going to understand how it potentially could have been wink unexpected. Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez met with electromagnetichealth.org's founder, Camilla Reese, to discuss his concern about the proliferation of wireless technologies in our midst and the link to illness, including cancer. We are pleased to be able to share his great words of wisdom, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So how interesting is that, that the guy had an untimely death after opening his mouth? And he mentions a lot of things in this interview, including he makes a remark about vaccines. But then the next interview, we actually found out last week, a couple of the Facebook executives from way back, Sean Parker was one, and then Chamath Pilipia was another, that came out and talked about the dopamine-driven feedback loops that fuel us to become addicted to our devices and our applications. I've talked before about that dopamine button in children. Well, we are also going to hear an interview, and this will be following the first interview. Another doctor with the first name of Nicholas, this is Dr. Nicholas Kaderis, and he is an addiction expert, and he discusses the risk to children from screen time and tech overuse. And he used to work in schools and things, and he found that kids were really becoming obsessed with this technology. And he really talks about some of the biological effects that occur and the dopamine button and how this fuels this ugly loop cycle that they get stuck into. So his interview is with the Manhattan Neighbors of Safer Telecommunications. And this really seems to be something that is being swept under the rug. And I think any of us who have children that are in schools being exposed to these technologies 24/7 need to really understand what is going on here and how this is a Trojan horse and how this really is going to damage the children's brains of the future. The first interview with Dr. Gonzalez talks about how maybe we can salvage some of these children now who aren't too damaged and fix them, which is beyond disturbing. So I hope you guys enjoy this. I have about 30 seconds left here. Sorry, it's Monday. Mondays are rough, but this is holiday week, and holiday weeks are always kind of stressful for me. I have family coming into town, so we need to do a full rip-apart house cleaning, which you guys, I'm sure you can imagine, I love. So it should be coming here any second. All right, here we go. Everybody take care.
The human body, as speaking now as a biologist and as a physician, was not designed to deal with the explosion of EMF activity in the environment. In the, it's not just in the air, but in the ground, and that's New York City, in the land, in the sea, everywhere. There's EMFs everywhere. You can't escape it. It's in the apartment buildings. The smart meters are in the apartment buildings. And this affects us. You know, we are ultimately an electromagnetic field. Everything that happens in our body is a series of chemical reactions that are electrochemical reactions. Nerve transmission is electricity. That's how it happens. The way we survive, the way we live, the way our brain works is through electricity. The conduction of electrical impulses through nerve axons is how we live. And that's all electricity. We have an electro field around us. You know, 20 years ago, conventional scientists would laugh, oh, we don't have an electricity. It's like they forget their first year of physiology where they talk about the electromagnetism of nerve impulses. You can measure that now. You know, Carilion field is not just some mysticism or crazy stuff from alternative doctors. It's real. We're an electromagnetic field. And if you don't think that all this electricity, which is all new, hasn't been tested, hasn't been put through clinical double-blind studies to see whether it's safe or not, is safe, it's a big risk. And we're all taking a risk. And I live in New York City, and I'm taking a risk. But then you move out to the country, and you have cell phone towers sprouting everywhere. My friend in Holland said that in the last 10 years, they've built 10,000 cell phone towers in Holland, which is a very small country. There's nowhere to go. You go to Australia, there's cell phone towers out in the wilderness now. So it's everywhere. And there's cell phone towers in New York City. There's no question that the proliferation of EMF activity in the environment is creating havoc among patients, among healthy people who then become patients. And there's no question that it's led, I believe, or at least contributing to the increase in cancer rates. I was talking to a friend of mine who's a physician just this morning who was talking about the explosion of cancer in children. Childhood cancer is exploding exponentially, not linearly, but exponentially. Well, why is that? Well, these kids are on the little devices. It's, you know, these kids, I watched my wife's nephew. He's like 8 years old. The guy's superb. He's been on a computer since he was like 3 years old. My neighbor has a two-year-old, three-year-old baby, you know, child. He's on a computer. He has a little handheld computer. He's doing it. These kids know how to do it. They grow up with that. And they're on these things hours a day. I didn't grow up with that. I grew up in the old days when you took your bicycle out to the dirt. Now they have all this computer technology with all these EMFs. They're being exposed to it. And then people wonder, why are brain cancer levels increasing? Why are these rare cancers increasing in children? Of course it's increasing. Yes, it's a complicated issue. It's the increased pollution. Pollution isn't getting better. It's getting worse. The quality of the food for the average person who doesn't eat organically is not getting better. It's getting worse. GMOs are a nightmare. That didn't exist 15 years ago. GMO foods, I believe, are toxic. And then you get the whole EMF thing, which is like this hidden mystery that no one is addressing. Even people in the alternative world tend to ignore it. It's no longer enough to, you know, eat organically and do your carrot juice and take your supplements and do your detoxification. Great, but what are you going to do about EMFs if you're living above a router that's giving you, you know, enough electricity to send a rocket ship to the moon? It's a real serious issue. There's no question in my mind that not only are the traditional diseases increasing in incidence because of EMFs as a contributory factor, I'm not saying they're the only factor, but they're a contributory factor that's really, I believe, going to be seen to be really deadly. But it's only going to get worse. It's only getting worse. And no one wants to address it because it's so convenient and it keeps the kids active. And it's high school kids now are all on computers. I wasn't on computers when I was in high school. I didn't know what a computer was. Thank goodness. One of the things I don't like to do is just create fear, which is easy to do. And there are a lot of frightening things out there. But one of our whole approach in our office is that even with the worst cancers, people can get well. It just takes more and more work because the environment is out to get you, and the environment is not getting better. The environment's only getting worse, and that includes the food, the pollution, and the EMFs. People have to become educated. No one's going to do it for you. The local town council isn't going to do it. The government isn't going to do it. The FDA, the CDC, the NIH, they're not going to do it for you. You have to become educated yourself. You have to do things in terms of your food. You know, find the best quality food, non-GMO, organic. Take the supplements that you think you might need and find a doctor that can help you, and learn about EMFs. If you don't learn about EMFs, it's not just a missing piece of the puzzle, but it may be like 80% of the puzzle is missing. I've had patients, no matter what they do, they They can't get well. It turns out that someone built a cell phone tower 100 feet from their home, and they didn't think that was important. But they haven't been trained to think that that's an issue. And I had that particular patient move, and suddenly she started doing better. So these are real issues. Now, you don't want to say, oh, God, I have to move my house. But there are things you can do. Everyone has to become involved in this if you care about your health. If you don't care about your health, just continue watching TV, get exposed to the EMFs, hope you don't get brain cancer at age 50. But if you're concerned about your health, concerned about your children's health, concerned about living the most productive and happiest life you can live, you got to work at it. Unfortunately, you have to work at it. One of the things that's concerned me, of course, children are the future of our country, of our planet, is that they're basically plugged into computers 24 hours a day. I think even when they sleep with their computers. Textbooks are now on computer. You know, when I was in school, we actually had regular books. They don't use that anymore. It's all on computer. All their tests are on computer. All their communications with the teacher. You don't raise your hand and ask the teacher. You go on, you email them. It's all on computer. I see this in my nieces and nephews, young nieces and nephews. They're basically tethered, is the word you've used, tethered to the computer all the time. They walk around with their iPhones. They walk around with their iPads. They walk around with their Kindles. They're always on the computer. This is electromagnetism going right into their body, which is an electromagnetic field, and there's unquestionable damage from that. There's no question that this is causing some disruption in their own electromagnetic field. And if we go back to what I said earlier, we are many things. Yes, we're a chemical body. We have vitamins and minerals in our body, but we're also an electromagnetic field, and it's the electromagnetism that allows us to survive. That's how nerves work, which controls everything. And there's no way that you're attached 24 hours a day, or 16 hours a day, to be more literal, to a computer or an iPhone or an iPad or a Kindle and not have disruption of your own nervous system. How is that possible? And they wonder why ADHD is exponential. Why is it exponential? Well, gee whiz, you're affecting the brain with all this electromagnetism. Might that have an effect? No, I don't think it's the only effect. We could talk about vaccination too. But unquestionably, when you're disrupting the electromagnetic field around a child who is very vulnerable, whose brain is still growing right up until they're like 21 years old, the effect cannot be positive. No one is going to convince me that the synthetic, high-dose electromagnetic assault on the human body in someone who's 8 years old is a good thing to the nervous system, which is a very delicately tuned magnetic field itself. It's just interruption. There's all kinds of disruptions. And it's going to cause long-term problems. And ADHD is going through the... Why is ADHD going through the roof? Look, when I was in school, I don't know anybody that had ADHD. I mean, kids would be kids, and there would be fights among the guys, and we'd play volleyball rough and all. But no one had ADHD and that kind of thing. I didn't know what autistic was until I went to medical school. Even then, when I was in school, we got 5 minutes on it. Now, one out of 50 boys has autism. ADHD is so common, it's considered normal. And their answer, of course, is to drug it. Well, what's the component with ADHD, this attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, with EMF exposure? I think it's certainly a major contributory factor. Why is it suddenly going up? If you look at the increase in ADHD and the increase in autism and the increase in EMF activity, there's a little lag time, but the curves are almost parallel in terms of the increase in the disease and the increase in use of these. I would call them dumb technology, not smartphones, dumb phones, because of what they do. Absolutely, I think this is going to be a catastrophe in them. It's already a catastrophe in the making now. And what we need to do is find some way to salvage the kids that haven't been so permanently damaged and try and repair the kids that have been damaged, which I believe is still possible because the human body is so malleable and so resilient when you give it the right things it needs and protect it from the things it doesn't need. So absolutely, we've got to learn how to protect our children. There are things that can be done to, you know, not have smartphones in schools, for example, and try and encourage kids to minimize the use. They're encouraging them to maximize the use because it's convenient, and they think it's all the with it technology that everyone needs.
This next interview is Dr. Nicholas Cardaris, addiction expert, discussing the risks to children from screen time and tech overuse.
I first became aware of the addictive effects on young people through technology in my work through school districts. I was working with adolescents, and about 10 years ago, I began to first see that there was an effect that was happening that looked like it was an attachment, an over attachment to telephones. But I didn't notice that as much as my first aha moment was when I had a young man that came into my office that had essentially a full-blown episode of video game psychosis. And he had been playing the game World of Warcraft for about 10 hours a night. And when he was sent to my office to see me, he didn't know what was real and what wasn't. He was fully in the game, or in the matrix, as I like to say. And that was my first shocking aha moment, because we know he was suffering from what's called derealization. And derealization is when you don't know what's real anymore. And we used to have substance-induced derealization, bad acid trips where people didn't know where they were in the acid experience or not. And now I was in live and in color. I had a young man who was having essentially a bad acid trip on a video game. And that's when I realized that there was something really wrong here, and that there was something very addictive and mind-altering about some of these technologies. I'm very concerned about the effects of technology, both nationally and globally. I've used the term digital heroin, and I've gotten some national media attention, some pushback about that, because I've had some comments about, well, certainly it's not as fatal as heroin. And obviously, I don't necessarily mean to imply that kids are going to be having the opiate epidemic overdoses that they're doing with heroin, but I really do believe that this is more problematic than substance addiction because of a couple of different factors: the ubiquity of technology and the way that technology has been essentially condoned by society. We have our guards up as parents about alcohol and drugs and just say no, but we've allowed this digital drug to slip past the gatekeepers of schools and our houses. And so while it may not be leading our children to have a fatal overdose, it's certainly stunting their development, creating addictive-like effects, and creating a whole host of emotional and mental health disorders. And the research is clear on that. And the fact that we're not as aware of that as we should be, that's what concerns me, because we've allowed this to explode without any sort of vetting or any sort of caution. The brain imaging study is very black and white, fortunately. It's very clear. The parallels are exactly the same with substance addiction as it is with screen addiction. And so what we're seeing essentially are two main fronts. We're seeing that the frontal cortex, which is the executive functioning part of our brain, shrinks when kids or young people are exposed to screens for excessive periods of time. That's exactly the effect that we see with chronic drug addicts. Chronic cocaine addicts have frontal cortex shrinkage. There's been several brain imaging studies that have shown that specifically. The second aspect is the myelination. The myelin sheath is that lipid, it's sort of the cable insulation wiring of our axons and our neurons. And the myelin sheath gets compromised. It's not as robust as it is when people are exposed to screens. The myelin sheath relates to our brain connectivity, how effectively and how fast our brain can operate. Brittle myelin leads to brain abnormalities, which have been correlated with things, developmental brain disorders like ADHD, with spectrum disorders at times, and also Alzheimer's at the end of the spectrum. So we've seen brain imaging studies that have shown myelin effects of cocaine. Dr. Bortzakis, he was an amazing neurology researcher at UCLA, had done cocaine myelin effects in the 1990s. And now that same research was replicated, showing those same myelin effects with screen time. Luckily, some of the brain effects that we've seen have some bounce back effect. There's a concept known as neuroplasticity, and where the brain can compensate. So the one study was on point to that effect. There was Dr. Wang at the Indiana University School of Medicine, and in the 2011 study, he showed that kids who had not been video game kids, who were exposed to violent video games for 2 weeks, showed this decrease in frontal cortex. Then they stopped playing for a couple of weeks, and they had some bounce back effect. What that study didn't show, what we don't have research on, is what does week after week, month after month, year after year of chronic screen exposure do? We know that after a couple of weeks, there was a bounce back effect. We don't know what that tipping point is. We don't know that what 20 years of 8 hours a day of video game playing is going to do neurologically to the brain. We just don't know. So in essence, we're doing a mass experiment on the whole generation of society. And we're saying, we wonder how this turns out on the brain effects. And the reality is we're beginning to see the canaries in the coal mine are beginning to appear. And we're seeing effects that we'd never seen before, rates of depression amongst adolescents. We're seeing something called erectile dysfunction in teenagers that was unheard of 20 years ago because of desensitization and some of these hyperexposure, hyperstimulating effects. The other brain imaging impact that we haven't really talked about that is a correlate to substance addiction is the dopaminergic effect of screens. Screens are a stimulant, and they raise dopamine levels. And in a study by Dr. Cope, K-O-E-P-P, they showed that video games were as dopamine activating as a sexual experience, 100% dopamine activating. So they raised dopamine levels 100%. Something like chocolate raises dopamine levels 50%. But my concern is that we're giving something as stimulating as a sexual experience to a 7 or an 8 year old. They're doing it for hour after hour after hour. And then we're asking them just stop or to regulate that behavior. The problem with children and this kind of hyperstimulating exposure is children don't have the neurophysiological apparatus to regulate themselves. They don't have a fully developed frontal cortex yet. That doesn't develop until you're in your early 20s. So the frontal cortex, we also call it the braking mechanism. You know, that's what tells us I shouldn't bungee jump or I should wear a bicycle helmet when I ride my bike. Those sort of that ability to do what if thinking isn't there for 7 or 8 year olds. So it's a perfect storm of dopamine activating hyperstimulation to vulnerable children who don't have the neurological apparatus to moderate that stimulation. So while an adult might be able to moderately drink or take another dopamine activating substance, a 7-year-old can't. And yet we're putting them in that situation where we're saying just play Minecraft for half an hour, and then wondering why they have these temper tantrums and now there's a whole new DSM disorder called mood dysregulation disorder, which a few people like Dr. Dunkley and myself think is a direct byproduct of hyperstimulated kids who have their devices taken away, who then can't control their emotions. My comparison with screen addiction versus substance addiction, and I mean this as sincerely as I can say it, is it's much worse from a treatment standpoint for a variety of reasons. I've treated heroin addicts, crystal meth addicts, alcoholics, you name it, you name the substance, and I've treated that. But we have standard treatment protocols in place for substance addiction, and we do know that abstinence is essentially the holy grail for addiction treatment. So once somebody crosses the line of, let's say, alcohol addiction, we know that essentially that person can't drink. But luckily, a person can live a happy and healthy life without alcohol. The problem with technology is its ubiquity. And so somebody who tries to be abstinent from technology, it's virtually impossible unless somebody lives in the shack with Ted Kaczynski. It's not easy to be abstinent. So I've worked with young people who were screen abstinent in therapeutic schools for a year or 2 years. And the moment that they parachuted back into their communities, and this has happened to me time and time again, even with all the therapeutic supports, even with all the treatment, they get exposed to technology again. They get a laptop or a smartphone or a desktop, and they fall right back into the rabbit hole. And that's what really concerns me, because it does seem to be a one-way, irreversible process, and yet we don't have a way to insulate these children or these young people from living a screen-free life in 21st century America. Part of the solution with treating screen addiction has to be preventative in nature, rather than once the problem crosses that ouch point of hardcore screen addiction. As I said, that becomes really difficult to cure, to treat. So part of the prevention, I think, is substituting or having a full, rich tableau of sensory experiences, music engagement, nature immersion, creative expression, all those types of opportunities which are neurosynaptically healthy. You know, we know that that developmentally what helps a young person develop and develop their executive functioning is hand-eye activities, playing with block Legos, not Minecraft, not digital Lego, because that's been sold as digital Lego, but it's not. Things that Waldorf schools do, color, music, sound, those types of experiences help develop the brain and develop the neurosynaptic connections rather than stunt their development, which is currently what's happening. So if you can get a child to immerse themselves in those kinds of experiences, then you're creating the antidote to a screen, what I call a high screen diet. Obviously, when we sort of triage this problem, there's some technology and some screen experiences that are more problematic than others. And if I go back to the drug analogy, we might say that crack or crystal meth has a more addictive potential than marijuana, for example, because, and there's some neurological reasons for that, mainly the dopaminergic effect. So there are some screen experiences that are more problematic than others, and there are some screen experiences that, by their nature, aren't as problematic. So some of us in the digital treatment world have identified digital vegetables versus digital candy. So a digital vegetable is something that can be relatively innocuous or healthy. You know, researching a homework assignment can be a good utilitarian use of technology. Mind-numbing, repetitive, sedating games like Candy Crush or Minecraft have no educational aspect, and what they are is just a hypnotic sedation. They're sedating and hyperstimulating paradoxically almost at the same time, because when a child is engaged in their screen, they look sedated, which is why parents love them as the digital babysitter, but while they look sedated, they're getting hyperstimulated. And that's why you see when you take away the toxin, you take away the screen, you see exactly the same reaction as we see in rehabs when you take away the drug from a drug addict. Explosiveness, anger, violence, aggression, exactly the same reaction. So I think we've been fed a fallacy. I think the honey that's made this technology taste good for society has been the false narrative of that screens are educational. And I think it's tapped into a basic insecurity that most parents have. Most parents, let's call this the helicopter parenting generation, they don't want to see their kids fall behind. There's this deathly fear of insecure parents that little Johnny and Susie are going to fall behind, and they need to have a leg up. And so they've been fed this honey-coated, I'm trying to choose my words carefully here, false narrative. I won't use any more powerful language than that, that technology is educational and leads to better outcomes, student outcomes. And the reality is the research doesn't prove that. There's been an array of studies and meta-studies that have looked at screens in the classrooms, and time again what we see is that screen-free classrooms, the students have better test scores. The students become better learners. Technology in the classroom essentially is a distraction. It gets in the way of the Socratic teacher-student exchange. And unfortunately, because it's an ed tech, education technology is a $60 billion a year global industry. I wrote an op-ed about this in Time magazine. There's an agenda. And there's an agenda to sell as much of it to as many schools as possible. And so I think some well-intentioned administrators and school officials have bought the company line from the tech companies. And let's face it, school administrators are human beings, and they have to worry about their jobs and so they're also trying to keep up with the Joneses as well. And I've seen this because I do a lot of work with school districts and administrators. So Superintendent X says, well, District Y just got tablets in middle school. We've got to give iPads to our elementary school. We've got to be a step up on that neighboring district. And if there's even the sense that I'm somehow behind technologically, I'm going to get the parents on me thinking that we're not providing the students with all the bells and whistles of education. When we know that education works best at its stripped-down finest, a good teacher in front of a classroom engaging students in a Socratic way tends to be the most effective way to engage the mind of a child, not the shiny bells and whistles, which effectively amplify the ADHD effect. And that's one thing I would like to mention, is what we are seeing is more screens, more ADHD. ADHD over the last 10 years has exploded. Now, some naysayers will say, well, it's just a byproduct of over-awareness and over-diagnosing an issue. I can tell you, having been on the front lines, that kids are more attentionally impacted. Their level of ability to attend is not what it used to be. And I don't mean to sound like an old fogey, kids ain't what they used to be, but the attention spans, I've saw it year by year by year, has reduced. And it's a direct byproduct of the screen world. We know that attention is a developmental window, that children develop their ability to have attention during roughly the same ages that they learn language. And that if that developmental window, in that period, if they don't develop their ability to focus, that developmental window tends to shut. You become a lifelong ADHD person. And so in those key periods when a child should be developing their ability to focus, again, hand-eye, slow-moving activities that help a child really sort of invest in attention, where bells and whistling, we're distracting kids in a way that they need to keep perpetually getting stimulated so that they can continue to be engaged. Most kids now, if you take away the hyperstimulation, will tap their feet and need some other type of stimulation. And so this narrative that we have to engage children with technology is perpetuating the engagement problem. I was a professor at graduate school at Stonebrook for 10 years, and early 2000s, the occasional laptop would come out. I taught in the lecture hall classroom, and you know, as the years progressed, it became a higher percentage of students with tablets. And by the time I stopped teaching, almost every kid every young person had a tablet or a laptop. Ostensibly, they were taking notes of the lecture, but as you would sort of walk around the classroom, chat windows would be open. There were multiple distractions for their attention happening on those screens. They were not just electronic ways to keep notes, unfortunately. And you saw it, the students weren't engaged. I wanted at one point institute a no kind of laptop policy for my students, but that was not what the university supported at the time. But you saw it as a professor, that students that were on their devices weren't fully as present for the actual lecture itself. So my children were in the public school, and I had conversations with the superintendent and the principal. And in fact, they were fairly receptive. They had me give a talk. In fact, I gave a presentation to the school. And so they allowed my children to not have to have tablets, because we didn't want them to have tablets. We were comfortable with them having some limited desktop once a week computer time. And they were in third or fourth grade, 1 hour a week of a very limited, very supervised a desktop experience. I have a screen opt-out letter in my book. I've been contacted by a lot of parents throughout the country. Some have been met by receptive school administrators, and some have been fought tooth and nail. I had an advocate for one woman on Long Island who, she had her kindergartner, she had a five-year-old, and the school was forcing her five-year-old to have a tablet. And she said, I don't want my five-year-old to have a tablet. I'm going to pull him out of school. They threatened to call CPS, Child Protective Services, on her. And what I had to remind the principal of when I called to advocate for her is that, by the way, five-year-olds aren't mandated to be in school in New York State, so it's not even a CPS issue. And second of all, do we really need to be threatening a parent with Child Protective Services because she doesn't want her five-year-old to have an iPad? And they eventually backed off, but this is the type of... And God bless him, when I spoke to the superintendent, he was supremely ill-informed about the issue. He was talking to me about, well, so these standardized tests that we have to give these kindergartners are on the tablets, and they're five. I think what's qualitatively different from this generation of technology, let's call it, than, let's say, television. Because we always get the naysayers of saying, oh, this is just another type of technology people were worried about. Look, Plato was worried about the written word. Plato thought the written word was going to atrophy our memory. So having said that, that every generation of technology has its Chicken Littles, the sky is falling, this generation of technology is qualitatively more problematic for a variety of reasons. Television was passive stimulation, and that 24-inch black and white rabbit-eared television stayed chained to its cabinet or wherever that television was 30, 40 years ago. And it was passive stimulation that we passively interacted with. Modern technology is immersive and interactive in the way that television never was. It's portable and ubiquitous in the way that television never was. So we've created this addicting effect with this dopaminergic hyperstimulation, which makes my brain tickle in a way that I want more, more, more. But I couldn't, well, I could, but it was more difficult to carry around that 24-inch black and white TV set from yesteryear. But now the digital drug dealers have given me portability. The problem with the portability has been this electromagnetic effect, because with portability comes a very Faustian deal. Portability has begat upon us a lot of physiological electromagnetic effects, which really, while sometimes when I do my talks about mental health effects, sometimes haven't gotten as much airtime, probably need to be given more airtime than mental health effects, because if we're dying of cancer or if we're dead, our mental health doesn't really matter that much at the end of the day. I mean, not that mental health is important, but at the end of the day, gliomas and brain cancers and some of the more dangerous aspects of the electromagnetic price that we're paying for our ubiquity and our portability is killing us. And so, yeah, little Johnny and Susie may have higher rates of ADHD, but they might be dead before they're a certain age at this point if we continue bombarding them with the radiation that we are. And so we have the World Health Organization with the 2011, with the carcinogen reports talking about the electromagnetic effect on things like smartphones and laptops and the reproductive effects when people have their laptops on their laps, and those effects that are what's happened to fertility rates. So there's a whole host of physiological damage that is really threatening our species. So in a perverse way, I'm focusing on the tip of the iceberg, but it's that 90% underneath the iceberg that's going to sink the Titanic, not that little visible piece that, but I think people like me and that are like-minded are saying whatever it takes to raise awareness about the global effects of this problem, mental health, physiological, electromagnetic, it's a problem and it's a significant problem, and we need to, as a society, begin to start educating ourselves so we could start being more tech cautious and start this rollout of technology that's seismically shifted our society and potentially doing some real damage to us. So I think the ethical responsibility of technology companies has been they've been entirely responsible. I mentioned to you before that even entities like the National Football League, monolithic sports empire, is at least has enough, whether it's public relations or whether it's civic responsibility, to have public service announcements about the potential for gambling and having spots about even alcohol companies with drink responsibly ads. The tech companies haven't even gone to that level to acknowledge either the addictive potential or the electromagnetic potential. I think they're afraid that if they do that in any way, that it's gonna kill the golden goose. So I think they're just sort of denying it. And I know that they know about the addictive effects because they're hiring. I've been sent APA class, employment ads where they're actively hiring behavioral psychologists to make their products addicting. So they know at the very least that they're addicting because they're hiring people to make their products addicting. How much knowledge they have about the electromagnetic effects, I think they're aware. I don't think they're, but I think it's blinded by greed. I think their mission statement from a corporate standpoint is sell more devices, and anything that goes counter to that, I think, gets ignored. There was an interview with a former Google and Intel executive. They were interviewing him in the New York Times article because he was one of many parents who lived in Silicon Valley who were sending their children to the Los Altos Waldorf School. And people found that interesting, that these Silicon Valley moguls were sending their people to tech-free schools. And he talked about, back in his heyday at Intel, how it was a battle of the eyeballs, and that's what the name of the game was, to get as many eyes on their screens for as long as possible. And let's face it, this is a very big industry with maybe not always the most ethical people involved. One of the main people that invested in education technology, one of the main people trying to shape the landscape that our children learn in, was Rupert Murdoch. Now, I'm not going to make any political aspersions, but Rupert Murdoch of Fleet Street is not known for his educational concerns for children. What he is known for is to be a very profit-driven media mogul. And he invested over $1 billion in Amplify, hired Joel Klein, who had been the former chancellor of the New York City schools, to be essentially his educational frontman, what I like to call his shill, and with the mission statement of selling tablets to every child in the United States from K through 12. I don't think Rupert Murdoch cares at all about educational process or the educational outcomes of our children. I think he saw it as a financial opportunity, and he grabbed it. Luckily, Rupert Murdoch didn't get the resonance that he was hoping for, and he has since sold out of that company, but not after trying very hard to give every developmentally non-equipped child a tablet in this country. I think one of the most problematic aspects of technology, and as we move forward, is the newer technologies of virtual reality and what we also call augmented reality. So virtual reality and holographic realities, which are a little slightly different. So virtual reality is an entirely synthetic reality, and an augmented reality is where we see reality and there's little holograms or Pokemons in our real world. First of all, children, from a child development standpoint, develop their sense of reality testing ages 2 to 8. If they're immersed in these reality blurring worlds, their sense of reality testing is much more compromised. And so we have a phenomenon called game transfer phenomenon, where children blur the lines between their game and the real world. We have countless cases of children who play Minecraft who begin to see the world in cube form. Years ago, at Harvard, they did a study that was called the Tetris Effect. And these were adult gamers who played the, by today's standards, innocuous game Tetris. Little tetraminos used to fall down, and there was a case study of 3 Tetris players, and they talked about seeing the Tetris cubes in their peripheral field vision and having dreams where they saw these tetraminos and waking up and seeing these squares. This level of technology, holographic, augmented, and even plain old two-dimensional, has a searing effect on the psyche, even for adults, but especially for children. So my fear and concern with augmented and virtual realities is that we're doing some real developmental damage, and where the children will opt for the virtual versus the real. If you're uncomfortable with your everyday life, if you're an uncomfortable adolescent going through the quirks and pains of adolescence, and you could escape, look, 20 years ago we escaped in drugs and alcohol, and we still escape in drugs and alcohol when you feel discomfort. But now you have another form of escape, and you could escape. So I've worked with a lot of adolescents who were bullied or picked upon or didn't have very good home environments, and they could create avatars that conquered worlds and lived in these archetypal fantasy worlds. And I might opt to do that too if my everyday life was untenable. So there's a real danger of kids losing themselves in these false worlds because they're perhaps a more palatable experience in their everyday life, but they won't learn how to work through their everyday life or experiences. I had a young man who was by his own account, an addictive video gamer, but he was pretty articulate, and we had these, I treated him for about 2 or 3 years, and he wanted to be a professional video gamer. He wanted to be an e-athlete. And he then experienced a holographic version, I'm sorry, not a, a virtual reality version of his game. And he came back to my office and he said, "Oh my God, Dr. Cardaris, that was scary how powerful that experience was. I'm afraid of that. I don't think I can control myself. I can barely control myself in the two-dimensional realm, but that 3D version, I don't know if I'd ever leave that." That's the danger. I think one of the most damaging things that screen technologies do is they rob children of their active imagination. And I think one of the almost uniquely defining aspects of being human is our sense of creativity and imagination. We have invented and explored and discovered things because of this active curiosity. You know, Plato talked about all philosophy begins in wonder, a sense of awe and wonder with the natural world. That sense of exploration, that has been dampened by screen technologies, which essentially program the imagery that a child sees in their mind's eye. So rather than doing the heavy lifting, which develops their certain neurosynaptic connections of imagining a story or creating something, which develops their ability to then sort of visualize and see things, they're getting programmed, that imagery. Years ago, I had read an interview with Graham Nash from Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, and he was talking about how they refused to make music videos about any of their songs. And when asked why, he said, "We don't want our listeners to be programmed with the images that we've created for them to see when they hear our music. We want them to create their own video in their own minds." And what we see is that when you program people's visual imagery, it begins to become a vestigial organ. They no longer have the ability to create their own imagery. They become almost a blank slate that needs the imagery programmed into them. That's what's happening. Imagination and creativity is getting dampened by this early exposure to screen content. Our most brilliant screen innovators, Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, the boys from Google, you know, Larry Page, they weren't exposed to screens until they were 12 or 13. They were Waldorf Montessori kids, or they didn't have any kind, Jeff Bezos. And so their minds were allowed to develop and use creativity, and then they were able to explore technology. But to queer that process by introducing the technology too soon into childhood, you're dampening any sort of creativity or active imagination, which won't then that child will grow up to be a user of technology, but not an innovator of technology. Art therapy, writing workshops, these are all creative expression ways that people sort of channel that archetypal, it's very Jungian too, you channel the source of your creativity is a deeper sense of, so absolutely, there's a therapeutic aspect. So using creative expression is absolutely a powerful method in trying to counteract screen issues. We as human beings are hardwired as social animals, and we need social connection. We get ill, and we can die without social connection. Donald Hebb in the 1950s did this powerful isolation research, which you can never replicate today, but people in isolation go insane. They get physically ill. And in his study, in isolation and with sensory deprivation, they went insane. Within 72 hours, they started hallucinating. So we need human contact, and this false narrative of in the social media world that somehow we're amplifying or enhancing social connection. Dr. Dunbar was an anthropologist who came up with it was called the Dunbar number. He studied primate groupings and primate grooming. And primates had the same number of clusters, of social clusters, as human beings did. And the Dunbar number basically said that primates and human beings, we can have about 150 social acquaintances, let's call them, in our village, in our social cluster. But we need five, but he called it the five number, of close interpersonal relationships to have emotional well-being, to have emotional health. And what's happening is that the social media illusion has created a sense of social connectivity when in fact it's robbed us of interpersonal social connection, which seems, but the research seems to show that the social media is not even a shortcut. It's not a shortcut to social connection. It's a false promise of social connection. There's a lot of research that shows that the phenomenon of Facebook depression. The more number of friends on Facebook, the higher my depression level is. And there's a couple of reasons for that. It's the social comparison effect. But it's also a sense that I'm in a room alone somewhere looking at a glowing screen, and I'm not engaging in face-to-face human interactions, which are, I won't say life-sustaining, but humanity-sustaining. And that's what we're robbing ourselves of with this latest age of technology as well. The role of nature both in our mental health and as a counterbalance to technology immersion is critical. It takes about 50 generations for us to change genetically. Genetic change doesn't happen overnight. And essentially, we've changed our society overnight. We are still in the hunter-gatherer bodies and minds. And yet we've turned very sedentary, very isolated, very anxiety. That's not our natural way of being. Dr. Ilardi, who wrote this wonderful book, The Depression Cure, a few years ago, and they looked at indigenous cultures, and the Papuan New Guinea, 2,000 Papuan New Guineans, had no depression. All 2,000, and an anthropologist who lived with them for 10 years found no cases of depression amongst the Papuans. And they attributed that to their lifestyle. They lived in these communal, nature-immersed, active, non-sedentary lifestyles that were really curative for a lot of mental health ills. So we've really created a society that lends itself to neurosis, anxiety, depression. We're boxed in, and we've, in the way that our genetics were not intended for us to live. And so the counterbalance to that is to sort of go back to a more nature-based way of living, at least less sedentary and more outdoor-driven. Dr. Ilardi had done as a study. He introduced some of those aspects into a study with 900 depressed clients. And they had to do 8 weeks of communal activity, exercise, some sunlight, and some omega-3s. That was the other part of it. And the success rate was almost triple of that of antidepressants. So our lifestyles have become toxic, and technology has been a big amplifier of that toxic lifestyle. I think parents, when it comes to technology, need to be aware that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So the most important thing I could recommend to a parent is delay the onset of technology. So if you can wait till your child is, you know, I say 10, Victoria Dunkley, Dr. Dunkley will say 12, but wait. If at all possible, wait. That's going to give your child your best shot at this. But if your child has been exposed to technology, things to look for are what we call mood dysregulation. Is your child getting very mood dysregulated when their devices are taken away or when they don't have their devices? Are they beginning to show attentional problems? Those are the big red flags to do. And if you begin to see that, that's when you have to start pulling back their exposure to devices. With school staff and administrators, I would ask that they look at the research, and I would ask that they show any compelling research that shows that there's any benefit for this expensive teacher-replacing intervention. The London School of Economics did a 10-year longitudinal study last year that looked at phones in the classroom. And in England, unlike in the United States, they're beginning to take phones out of the classroom. We're unfortunately going in the opposite direction. And they found that test scores went up by 6%. This was a study with over 140,000 students over 10 years. Test scores across the board went up 6%, but specifically with students who had special needs or more compromised socioeconomic backgrounds, test scores went up 14%. And the London School of Economics study said, quote, the best way to reduce the achievement gap is to remove phones from the classroom. And yet we have administrators, again, just raising the white flag either saying that the parents won't let me do it. I get that a lot. The parents want their kids to have the phones in the classroom, which is absurd. You know, there are phones that you can call if you need to reach your, you know, we used to call the office, the school's office, the main office. And with technology companies, I would ask them to look deeply and find their soul. I can understand that they're excited about having created this new innovation that has shifted our entire planet. But I would ask that with that power come some sense of responsibility, and that to at least acknowledge that there's the potential for some real damage that we're seeing now. And if there is that potential, to begin to have a social consciousness where they provide at least, I have a change.org petition that we're trying to enact legislation to at least put warning labels on some devices. The label would read, excessive screen usage can lead to clinical disorders in children, that the technology companies at least acknowledge that that reality exists, because it exists. The research shows it. The case studies show it. And that they perhaps be more cautious about exposing children to some of these devices. I do think that the education technology industry, the ed tech, or the educational technology industrial complex, is a big scam. I do think that it's a money-driven enterprise that doesn't have the children's interests at heart. Pearson Publishers, they had done some wiretapping of some of their executives, and I talk about this in my book, and one of the quotes from their senior marketing executives was, it's not about the kids, we don't care about the children, it's about selling software, it's about selling, you know, now it's Common Core. Anything that they can do to sell, I think they do. And I think if somebody wants to be a capitalist, more power to them, but not at the expense of our children. They're shooting fish in a barrel, and as a parent, I'm outraged. As a psychologist and a clinician, I'm outraged, and I think more parents and more on the grassroots level, more of us need to be outraged to put a stop to this.